last week, Katie and I went to see my parents in London. Now, every time we drive out of Bath, we have the same conversation. Which way do we go to the motorway? I find that people have their own favourites and their own theories about which is going to be fastest at which time of day. Lansdowne route is longer, but the London Road route is going to give you traffic. We have this conversation every time we leave Bath to go somewhere. My personal view is, it doesn't matter which way you go. But actually, the people we were going to see, they didn't mind which way we went. Actually, they really didn't mind what we did on the journey. They didn't mind what colour car we drove, or what music we were listening to. They didn't mind whether we stopped at Lee Delamere or Reading. They were just interested in us getting to the destination and seeing them. Does it matter how Israel got to the Promised Land? This book of Numbers is a book about a journey. As we saw last week, the Israelites are journeying from Egypt, where God had rescued them, to the Promised Land. They're on the road, heading for this destination, and they're heading for a good place. They're heading for the land of milk and honey. They're heading for the land where God has promised to bless them. They're heading for the place where God is going to make them secure and safe and build them into his nation, in his land, under his rule. The question then arises, does it matter how they get there? Does it matter what they do on the journey? Does it matter that they act like God's people before they get to his land? After all, many of the laws that God has given them only apply to the land. For example, don't move your neighbour's boundary stone. That only applies when you've been given your land. All the laws about the feasts that we've just seen in Leviticus, well, they only applied when the people were in the land and looking back on their journey. They didn't apply until they got there. So should the Israelites wait until they reach the land to implement all of these laws that God has given them? Did it matter now on the journey? That question is relevant to us as Christians today, because the New Testament repeatedly compares our situation with the situation of the Israelites in Numbers. They had been saved from Egypt and were on the journey to the Promised Land. We have been saved by the death of Jesus in the past, and we are heading towards God's new creation in the future. We're on a journey. We're also in between. And we might well ask the question as well, does it matter how I get there? If I basically do trust Jesus, if I'm going to make it to the finish line, to the destination, does my lifestyle today really matter? Maybe we wouldn't put it as starkly as that, but we can slip into the thinking, God's going to make me holy one day. Does it really matter how much progress I make in the meantime? And I think this passage in Numbers is really helpful for us on this question. It may not be the most straightforward, but I think when you get into it, actually looking into the detail reveals a passage that's very coherent and very relevant for us. Does it matter how we get to the destination? Well, our first heading, yes, it does. Purity can't wait. Purity can't wait. Look at the beginning of chapter 5. What we have in these chapters are instructions about purity, and they apply immediately. They apply to the journey. Verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, command the Israelites to send away from the camp anyone who has an infectious skin disease or a discharge of any kind, or who is ceremonially unclean because of a dead body. Send away male and female alike. Send them outside the camp so they will not defile their camp where I dwell among them. So this is, we can see, about the camp. This is about where they pitch their tents on the journey. And it's about uncleanness. The camp must be pure. Must not be made impure by contact with dead bodies and diseases. This is an instruction about purity. It is effective immediately. And the rest of this section follows that theme. Verses 5 to 10, if you glance at them, you could say that those are about purity in relationships. So verse 6, if there's sin between two people, there's guilt, there's unfaithfulness, that must be dealt with. Sacrifice needs to be offered, restitution needs to be made. The rest of chapter 5, you could say, is about purity in marriage. It's about adultery, and the words used are impurity and defilement. The impurity caused by adultery must be dealt with. And then most of chapter 6 is about this Nazarite vow that people could take to dedicate themselves to serving God. And it's about how they set themselves apart, how they purify themselves for service. So here we have in these two chapters instructions for purity that apply right now to the journey. But we've also got the reason why purity can't wait. Look again at the start of chapter 5 and verse 3. Send away male and female alike. Send them outside the camp so they will not defile their camp where I dwell among them. Why do they need to be concerned about purity now? Because God dwells with them now. We can see the same logic from a different angle right at the end of the section, the end of chapter 6. If you glance at chapter 6, verses 22 to 27, the blessing that Aaron was to say over the people. We'll look at it again later, but for now just focus on verse 27. What's Aaron doing when he says this blessing over the people? Verse 27, so they'll put my name on the Israelites and I'll bless them. They'll put my name on the Israelites. Not the first time this idea occurs in the Old Testament, the idea that Israel were the named people of God. So God is with the people, God's name is on the people, and both those things are true right now on the journey. And that is why they must be concerned with purity right now on the journey. They're the place God chooses to dwell. They're the people God chooses to put his name on. So in a sense, they're representing God to the world. If I have my name on a product, I don't want it to be shoddy, because that would say something about me that I don't want. When my children are teenagers, I don't want them to become hooligans or thugs, for many reasons, but partly because they'll be living in my house and they'll be bearing my family name. And their behaviour will reflect on me. So it really does matter how they act on the journey. Now, actually, that is very easy to apply to us. We're Christians, after all. We bear the name of Christ now, today. We're a Christian church, and God is with us, says the New Testament. God's Spirit dwells in individual believers and in his church. And Paul makes a connection explicitly between both of these two truths and the implication that we need to live in a way that's consistent with that. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul says, I'm writing to you that you must not associate with anyone who bears the name of brother, but is sexually immoral. Well, we'll think that through the practicalities of that in a minute, but can you see the same logic here? The behaviour, the purity of the people who bear the name really matters now. He goes on in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 to say this, don't you know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit? Therefore, honour God with your body. Can you see it's the same logic? God dwells in you, so it matters what you do with your body. Those are two wonderful privileges to have as Christians, to have God's name and God's presence. And they're true today. We have those blessings now on the journey. We're not waiting for them. But that means the implication is today too. We must care about purity today. We must care about what we do as individuals and as a church. Are we living consistently with those two truths? That's a question that we have to ask ourselves. In what I'm saying, in how I'm acting, am I representing God to the world as he is? Purity can't wait. Well, in the light of that, let's have a quick look at some of the practicalities of purity. What does this section have to teach God's people about being pure? Purity in practice. You can say there are kind of two sides to it here. On the one hand, in chapter 5, there's dealing with impurity, the kind of negative of dealing with sin. On the other hand, in chapter 6, we've got a positive dedication to purity for service. We'll take them one at a time. Dealing with impurity. Let's briefly review those three areas of impurity that chapter 5 mentions, and let's have a look at the actions the people are to take. The first action is separation. If there's impurity in verses 1 to 4 because of contact with dead bodies or disease, the action you have to take is separation. You send that person away. It's not permanent separation. You can read more details, laws elsewhere that cover those situations. After a certain amount of time, the unclean person can come back in. If you recover from your disease, you can come back in. But the strategy to deal with this impurity is separation. And secondly, verses 5 to 10, the action to be taken is restitution. So this is the case of someone wronging someone else. The wrongdoer has to make it right. They have to repay what they took or what they broke, plus a fifth. Not just that. They've got to take a ram of atonement, verse 8. They've got to take a sacrifice to the priest. So the strategy here is restitution, making things right and dealing with the impurity of sin that way, making it right with both the human person and with God. And then finally, the third section, the third action, is an action that isn't actually an action that the people take at all. So the third section in chapter 5 is about adultery. We'll need to think about this a bit more, so we'll come back to it. But for now, just notice the big point. Adultery causes impurity, and if the woman is guilty, she will be judged by God. Verse 27, she'll suffer this pain that causes barrenness. The action is judgment, but that is something that God does. Three sections, three kinds of impurity that God's people need to deal with. Now, I find this very realistic. These are realistic chapters of Numbers. Note that it doesn't say here, Israel, keep the law perfectly, never be impure. At this first sign of impurity, I'm going to wipe you out. God doesn't say that to the people. There's realism here. There is going to be sin amongst the people. Just because they're to strive for purity doesn't mean God will wipe them out at the first sin. Rather, he gives them ways that they must deal with the impurity. I find the New Testament to be similarly realistic about the people of God today. The goal is purity, but the expectation, realistically, is that there will be issues, but they need to be dealt with. We're tempted to go with either wrong extreme. Either there must be purity, there is no second chance, or on the other hand, well, we're never going to be perfect, so who cares? Actually, these instructions to God's people are neither of those. This is strive for purity. There will be problems, and you must deal with the problems. And I kept coming back, as I looked at this, to 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians is a letter Paul writes to the Corinthian church, which is full of him dealing with all kinds of issues. It's very realistic. There are problems. There are very serious problems in that church. But Paul doesn't give up on them. Nor does he say, oh, never mind, that's fine. No, he deals with their problems. He gives them instructions to deal with what's wrong. And actually, I think you can find all three of these actions from Numbers going on in Corinth and in the New Testament. I guess you don't have to look hard to find verses that deal with Christians wronging each other. That will happen. It will happen at Emmanuel. We need to be realistic about that, but we also need to be determined to make it right. When that does happen, we need to confess and ask for forgiveness. And we need to forgive. As we live together in church, we need to know God says, when that happens, deal with it. Make it right. Don't give up on God's people. Don't ignore problems either. Make it right. That's a vital reminder to us. Perhaps more surprising for people to find is that Paul also talks about both separation and divine judgment in the church too. Paul says to the Corinthians, as we quoted earlier, I'm writing to you, you must not associate with anyone who calls himself a brother but is sexually immoral. There is a place for separation. We bear the name of God. We represent God to the world. God dwells in his church. So, if there's a person claiming to bear the name, but living unrepentantly in sin, we must separate from them. And by doing that, the church declares to the world, the way that person is living is not a true picture of God. That's a last resort action. It is also for the good of that person that they recognise the danger they're in and repent. It is there as a command for the churches. And there's also direct divine judgment in the New Testament, which Paul speaks about as having happened to the Corinthian church. He talks about people who've become sick and even died because of God's judgment on serious sin issues within the church. We need to be pretty careful about applying that. But what it does for us, at the very least, is underline that sin within the church is a serious thing. God is still serious about sin within his people, and he will judge it. He takes it seriously. We must take it seriously too. We need to look briefly at the other side as well. There's dealing with impurity, but there's also dedication for service. Chapter 6. We don't really have time for the details, but the big picture is this. It's all about a voluntary vow of service to God. An Israelite person who wants to serve God, to be set apart for service, can do this. They can choose to put themselves under these regulations. Verse 2 of chapter 6. They come under these regulations for a time to demonstrate to God and to others that they're committed to his service. Now, there are some outward things that they do as a sign of their dedication. No eating or drinking grape produce, growing long hair, staying away from dead bodies. And they also offer sacrifices, the whole range of sacrifices, verses 13 and onwards. So the expectation here is that the people in Israel, there are going to be people in Israel who want to serve God and who want to be really serious about it. And it will mean being purified, staying away from dead bodies and taking that very seriously. Verse 7, even if a family member dies, you can't break out of this vow to deal with that. This is a serious business, but it's a good thing. It's a good thing to want to volunteer for serious service of God. The expectation is that there will be people in Israel who are doing this, serious about serving God. I think quite quickly, there is a line of application to us as we seek to serve God as Christians. Simply that serious dedication to that is good. Serious dedication to serving Jesus is good. None of us can take serving Jesus too seriously. And if we want to serve God, we need to be pure. The Nazarite mustn't go near a dead body. That's ceremonial purity. Paul talks to Timothy about wanting to be set apart as holy and wanting to be useful to the Master, useful to God. And he says, if you want to be useful, Timothy, to God, well then, flee youthful passions and pursue faith, hope and peace. It's good to want to be used by God, to be serious about serving God. And if what we most need, if we want to be that, is personal godliness. Not a master's in theology, good thing though that might be, but godliness. Well, I'm going to pause there for a second. In a sense, we've covered most of the ground in these chapters already, but I think there is another level to this, and there's more to say. Let's dive back in, and we're going to go back to the adultery ritual, because we do need to think about that a bit more. It's striking how detailed it is. You could have had a much simpler law that did the same job. So the question is, why all the detail? And also, of course, people may ask, reading this, isn't it all rather unfair? Why should the wife have to go through this ordeal? And why is it only for the wife? Don't men commit adultery too? Well, firstly, if we're going to understand it, we've got to put it in context of the rest of the law. So the rest of the law in the Old Testament has other instructions about adultery. You've only got to think of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery. The law elsewhere says adultery is punishable by death for both men and women alike. However, the death penalty can only be applied when there are at least two witnesses. This law we've got here in Numbers clearly only applies when there's no witness. Verse 13. So this is not the main law about adultery. This is not the first law about adultery. This is a specific last resort kind of law. And the key word throughout the section seems to be jealousy. That keeps getting repeated. So verse 14, when feelings of jealousy come over the husband. The situation here is that a husband is jealous of his wife, suspicious, but doesn't have evidence to prosecute. Now think about it. That situation is both realistic, but also very frightening for a wife in ancient culture. It's a very dangerous position for her to be in. The man is stronger, physically and economically. The man's the one who's supposed to protect and provide for his wife and her children. So it is far more dangerous for her to be in this situation of suspicion than the other way round. She's very vulnerable to the man taking the law into his own hands and abandoning her and her children, based on suspicion and jealousy. So this law is here, I think, to disallow him from doing that. This law tells him what he must do in the case of jealousy and suspicion. Verse 15, this is what he must do. He must take his wife to the priest. Now compare that to what the Quran says. This is Surah 4, verse 34. Talking about wives, as to those on whose part you fear desertion, admonish them and leave them alone in the sleeping places and beat them. That's very different, isn't it? This law is here in the Bible to avoid that situation. Yes, so that the sin of adultery is taken seriously and dealt with, but also to protect the wife against an unjustly jealous husband. And actually, when you look at the detail, this is not an ordeal. Think about what actually happens. If we pare it down to what actually happens, it's that the priest takes a jug of water, verse 17, into which he puts some dust from the tabernacle floor. He writes curses in a book, verse 23, and washes them off into the water. And then the woman drinks the water. That is all she does. Drinks water. It's got some dust and some ink in, so it might not taste the best, but the water itself is just water. It's not going to do her any harm. This is not trial by ordeal. This is not like throwing a witch into a pond to see if she sinks. All the wife does here is drink water. It's almost as if she's presumed innocent, because any judgment on her has to come directly from God. Which makes sense, because this is a situation where there are no human witnesses. Only God knows about the guilt of the woman, so any judgment comes directly from him. And if she doesn't suffer the effects of the curse, then she's innocent. And crucially, she's protected. The husband has got to put away his jealousy because she's been proved innocent. And if she is guilty, the judgment comes from God. Now, I think that explains this law on a human level, why this is a good thing for society. But it doesn't necessarily explain why there's all the symbolism, the detail. Why is adultery treated differently like this? Well, I think it is because of what marriage is for. Marriage is a picture, all through the Bible, a picture of God's relationship with his people, as it is supposed to be. His faithful covenant love to them, his provision and his care for them. The Bible tells us God has designed marriage for many reasons, but the heart of it, the key, the most important reason that we have marriage at all, is that it is a picture. It is this picture of how God loves his people. But sadly, in the Bible, adultery is a picture too. It is a picture of how we treat God. It's a picture of the inclination of the human heart to desert the faithful love of God. Just look at verse 12 of chapter 5. Adultery here is described as the wife being unfaithful to her husband. But if you look up the page to verse 6, the same word, unfaithful, is used to describe sin. When a man or woman wrongs another in any way, they are unfaithful to the Lord. So I think this adultery ritual in its detail and richness tells us truths about marriage, which tell us truths about God and how he relates to his people. It's clear from this law that marriage is supposed to be pure. It is supposed to be entire, complete, lifelong faithfulness. And breaking that faithfulness is defilement and uncleanness. There's a sense in which the husband is expected to be jealous. Wrongful jealousy could be a terribly destructive thing, but on the other hand, it is right to be concerned about purity in marriage. It's right to be jealous for the pure love of your spouse. I don't know if you noticed another word that is repeated most often, actually, in this section. Is curse. The word curse comes over and over again. Adultery brings defilement, and the adulterer will suffer the curse. Verse 23, the priest writes the curses in a book. That's very symbolic, isn't it? And the guilty one suffers the punishment of the curse, the pain, the childlessness. And verse 27, she will become a curse among her people. I wonder if writing down curses in a book sounds familiar to you. It might do if you were here back on November 23rd, when we were looking at Leviticus 26, where Moses wrote out both the blessings that would come on the people if they were faithful to God, and a long list of curses they would suffer if they were unfaithful to him. God is utterly committed to his people, and so he's rightly jealous for their complete faithfulness to him. We're talking about instructions for purity here. Well, this is the standard of purity that we end up with. How faithful, how pure must God's people be? 100%. What less would do, after all, in a marriage? Could a husband say to his wife on their anniversary, "Darling, I think I've been faithful to you 98% of the last year. That's a pretty stunning mark. You should be really very, very pleased with me." It doesn't work like that. All of which means purity is a problem. Purity is a massive problem for us. We need only look at what happened to the people of Israel. Because the nation of Israel, in a sense, was supposed to be like the Nazarite. Of chapter 6, they were supposed to be the set apart nation. They're supposed to be the ones who serve God, set apart, dedicated for his service, the ones who have his name on them. But by the end of the Old Testament, They've been vomited out of the promised land to which they were going. And God's verdict on them was, you adulterous people. They became, in the words of the Bible, a desolation and a curse. That's where the people ended up, suffering the curse because of spiritual adultery. And that is a real problem, because that is what they are like, and we would have done no better, because none of us meet the benchmark of purity before God. Which makes you ask, who will ever receive the blessing at the end of chapter 6? Who is ever actually going to be able to stand with God's face shining on them? Well, there is one person who lived a life of 100% faithfulness to God. One person who dedicated himself to pure service of God and carried it through. One person who was obedient to God in all things, even to death. One person whom the Father has permanently blessed. It's in Jesus that we find access to everything these chapters set before us. Access to purity on the one hand and access to blessing on the other. In Jesus we find the chance to share a record of perfect cleanness, faithfulness and obedience. And the chance to find our adulterous record taken away. After all, Jesus lived like the Nazarite, but he died like the adulteress. Galatians 3 puts it like this. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it's written, cursed is everyone who's hung on a tree. He redeemed us in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Christ Jesus. He suffered our punishment. We get his perfection. And standing united with Jesus, we stand with the one on whom the Father's face has shone for eternity in blessing. And so, today, God's people are those who bear the name of Christ. That's how we bear his name today. And that tells people something. It tells them everything that we thought about earlier. It tells them we represent God. And it implies to us that we must live like it, in purity, in the ways we thought about earlier. But it also now tells them something else as well. It tells them that we only think we receive God's blessing. We only think we stand with God's face shining on us through Jesus and his purity. It reminds us to look to Jesus today. That's where we find blessing and purity. For right now, as we look to Jesus in his word to change us. And that itself is the blessing at the end of the journey, at the destination to where we're going. To see him face to face. What's our destination? Here's how 1 John puts it. When he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is.